This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Utah's governor, Gary Herbert. As we broadcast today's show, the election is but 1 week away. Some Utahns have already voted by mail, but many more are still deciding. Governor Herbert has served for 7 years, and he is seeking another 4-year term. Pollsters tell us that the economy and education rank among Utah voters' most important issues, so that's what we'll focus today's conversation on. The governor's narrative in this election is that Utah's economy is thriving. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country, and our economy is the fourth most diverse in the nation. A recent Zions Bank Consumer Attitude Index reports that Utahns are feeling more confident about the present and future economy. But this rising tide has not lifted all boats. Economic inequality is a problem nationwide, and unfortunately, Utah is no exception. There is a sense that even though the economy has gotten better for some, the working poor are being left behind. While Utah's growth ranks number 3 in the nation, more than 58,000 Utahns remain unemployed, and tens of thousands of other working-age adults are stuck in low-paying jobs. Salt Lake City also faces a severe lack of affordable housing. This station's broadcast studio is on the campus of Salt Lake City's main library, and we see on a daily basis the pain caused by homelessness and the urgent need to better address this issue. With that as our backdrop, let's begin today's conversation. Governor Herbert, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you today.
So let's start with economic inequality. As I mentioned, it's a nationwide problem. It's also, unfortunately, a problem in Utah. What are your thoughts on that issue and some things we can do to help solve it?
Well, we've been very successful in creating the most diverse, healthiest economy in America today. And so that means there's opportunities out there. But even though our unemployment rate is at 3.4%, that means there's 3.4% of our population which are not employed, and some may be underemployed. The key is in the marketplace, in my view, is education, training, skills. We've been listed in America as the best labor force in America today, best place for startups. That means we have opportunities to start up new businesses and employ more people. And usually when you're under 4% unemployment, most economists consider that kind of full employment because people are always transitioning back and forth. But for those who, in fact, are out of work, we have a Medicaid program, for example, that we, in fact, not only do give you health care, but we also help you get a job so that the average length of time in Utah that people are on Medicaid is only 9 months. Because we get you in, we help you, and then we also help you get skills and training and education so you can go back out and find a better job and get off government assistance. That's kind of a Utah culture thing. The good news for us all, in spite of the challenges, and there's always challenges, I mean, Jesus said the poor will always be with us, so we do have that need out there, and we need to all have a role to play to help elevate people out of poverty. But because we've had a healthy economy right now in Utah, our poverty rate is one-third below the national average, one-third below the national average. And we are the lowest in America today. Our youth poverty is half the national average. When Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House in Congress, talks about what he would like to do, and he talks about this is a pet issue for him, helping get people out of poverty, help them to become self-supporting, he uses Utah as the example of a state that's doing it right. So I'm very pleased with our progress and our success. We recognize there are pockets of problems out there, particularly in some of our rural parts of Utah. Energy prices are down. Those that have been reliant upon a single source for their economy, like the Uinta Basin, with so much is beholden to energy development, Carbon, Emery County, some in Sevier County. We know those areas are challenged because of that one sector, which is why we've worked so hard to diversify our economy as a state and why we're not fourth now. We're third most diversified economy in America today.
Well, we're going to talk about coal a little bit later, but you mentioned Medicaid and the help that the state can do with training and getting people back into jobs. You had a program to expand Medicaid in the state. It was called Healthy Utah. The legislative body decided not to pass that. They passed something that was dramatically scaled back from what you had planned. How important is comprehensive health care coverage for for the lower income people? And what do we do at this point to get that to the people that need it?
Well, let me preface that by saying that I think the Affordable Care Act, as commonly referred to as Obamacare, is flawed. It was a bad piece of legislation passed on strictly partisan lines, and it's become very divisive in our country. And until it's fixed, it will continue to be divisive. We challenged it in court. It's not only a flawed piece of legislation, but been compounded by the Supreme Court decision, which was a little bit puzzling, because we challenged it on the Commerce Clause, saying you cannot have the federal government tell a consumer what you must buy. That's contrary to kind of the American values and what we've learned under the Constitution. But when it went to the Supreme Court, the Obama administration changed the argument and said, well, we've been calling it a penalty if you don't participate, but now we're going to call it a tax. And so, as John Roberts, the Chief Justice, said, because it's a tax, it's now mandatory that you pay the tax and the cost for the Affordable Care Act, but it is voluntary if you expand the Medicaid program. So we have to pay. We have all the pain of paying the tax, but we don't enjoy any of the benefits. So I was just a common sense here. I've been given lemons. Is there some way to make lemonade out of it? And if we're going to have the pain of paying the tax, we'd have some of the benefit of utilizing that money in a way that Utah thinks would be appropriate. So this is not Medicaid expansion. This was an alternative to Medicaid expansion we called Healthy Utah. And you're right, it didn't pass, but it passed in the Senate. In a vast majority, it really never got a hearing much in the House, and then it kind of fizzled out and didn't pass there. So, I don't think the issue of health care is going to go away. The question is how to address it. We see, I think there's been suppression of premiums purposely by a political agenda. I think this next year you're going to see premiums go up under the Affordable Care Act for insurance, on an average of 17% to 20%. Some states as high as 50%. We have providers that are dropping out of the exchange system. Some states only have one provider left now. So there's a lot of problems out there.
So no solution is perfect, but what do we do to get more coverage for Utahns that need coverage?
Well, what we ought to be doing is addressing the issue of how can we, in fact, reduce the cost of health care. If you can reduce the cost of health care, it becomes more accessible, more affordable for everybody. At the time that the Affordable Care Act came along, only 13% of Utahns were uninsured. And half of those could afford insurance but chose, for whatever reason, not to purchase insurance. So now you've got only about 7% of your population that, in fact, doesn't have access to health care.
It's still a big number.
It's a big number, but why do we end up having the tail wag the dog? You know, why don't we address the root cause of rising costs of health care? All the Affordable Care Act did say was we're going to tell you how to pay for it. We're going to say these third-party people will pay for your rising costs of health care. Why don't we address the root cause? The root cause of the problem. One, we ought to get people jobs so they can afford to pay their own way. And two, we ought to work to keep the cost of health care down. And guess what? In Utah, we have the lowest cost of health care in America today, as we did, 5 or 6 years ago. And we have about the fourth or fifth ranked best quality of health care. So low cost, high quality. The Affordable Care Act really doesn't do much for Utah. We are one of those that are going to have to pay much more money for getting a lesser quality health care under the Affordable Care Act. So, again, we're kind of being abused and used here inappropriately. So if the question is, what do we do about health care, let's see what we can do to put more doctors in the marketplace, physician assistants, get more. I'm a big believer in supply and demand, and have do what we can to lower the cost. Tort reform, making sure we don't have to litigate everything. We have over-testing being done by doctors who are afraid I'm going to litigate, I'll be sued. If I don't do 100 tests, there might be something that comes back and I'm going to be sued. So additional costs. We have third-party payers, so the individual doesn't have to take care of their own health care. It's like going shopping at the grocery store and saying, hey, you fill up your grocery basket, and by the way, this guy over here will pay for it, whatever you get, as opposed to you being responsible for your own budget spending.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Utah's Governor Gary Herbert. One of your solutions for health care is better jobs, getting people into jobs. Let's talk about the technology industry. It's been a bright spot for Utah, I would argue, not just over the last decade, over the last two decades, a lot of work's been done there. What's the next phase of that? What do we need to do to build on our success and to bring more high-paying quality jobs to Utah?
Well, the first thing is we need to understand and appreciate the free market capitalistic system that's been given to us by our founding fathers under our Constitution. It's the system that's given us the best products, the best services, for the lowest price, lowest cost, for the most people of any system ever devised by man. And yet we have people out there trying to change the system to make it more socialistic, to have government redistribute wealth, pick winners and losers. I'm a free market guy. And so what we're doing in Utah is, one, we're not betraying the principles given to us by our founders. We understand and venerate the private sector. We want to encourage the risk takers to go out there and risk their capital, have an idea, find a niche in the marketplace, and on that risk-reward system, which we call capitalism, have tremendous success. We see that happening here in Utah time and time and time again. We've been listed as the best place in America for startups. We've been listed as the best place for business in America multiple times. We're working hard to make sure our education is improved so our labor force has the skills necessary that align up with the demands of the marketplace. Government has a very minimal role in growing the economy. We ought not to be picking winners and losers, but we ought to create a fertile field, an environment that's conducive for the risk taker, so that people want to come here and say, you know what, I'll take a risk. We want to have competitive tax rates. We have regulation reform, which we've done. We've lowered our taxes. The lowest tax rate in the last 20 years today, lowest tax obligation in 20 years in Utah today. We've, in fact, improved with our regulations. We've gone through and counted them, and we've eliminated 368 of them. They ought to be doing that in Washington, D.C. We've said to the private sector, we care about your success. We want you to be successful. We want you to be successful by creating wealth. As you create wealth, you create jobs. We want you to become wealthy. And we have people out there arguing and fighting against people with wealth as if somehow that's a bad thing. If you don't like a rich guy, try to get a job from a poor person. It's pretty hard to do. So we want to have startups. We want to have small business to say this is a great place to do a business. And if we do that, you can't become a large business unless you first start out as a small business. So the fact that we are kind of the epicenter for small business, startups, and growth is a good, healthy sign that we are a very friendly environment for the wealth creators, the risk takers, the capitalists out there who are creating jobs, which is what's being done and has always been done in America.
You know, just recently, the Facebook trained to track Facebook to Utah for their data warehouse. It was reported there were incentives of just over a quarter of $1 billion being offered to Facebook to get them to move here. What are your thoughts on the corporate incentives in the process of incentives to attract companies like Facebook to the state?
Well, in my world, it's just a level playing field that everybody competes on the same footing, and there's no incentives given to anybody. If you like the market, if you think you have an opportunity, you've got an idea you want to invest in, get people to invest with you, invest capital and develop your business, that's the way it ought to work. Unfortunately, what's happened over time is we have a competition from other states to say, well, we'll put in your infrastructure. We'll pay for this. We'll give you money if you'll bring your businesses here. And so Utah has to compete in the marketplace, and our legislature has been very wise in creating parameters as far as how that happens. In spite of some of the rhetoric and the misunderstanding, any incentive that Utah gives, and it comes from local communities, the Facebook issue was really a debate between West Jordan and Salt Lake County. Salt Lake County originally gave a very rich package, which West Jordan, interestingly enough, rejected. And then West Jordan came back, and then Salt Lake County rejected theirs, even though it was lesser than what they originally offered. And we had this kind of fighting going back and forth. Our incentive programs in the state are designed to be what we call post-performance. I'll use Adobe as an example of one the GoEd office, the state office, was involved with. We were really not involved in the Facebook thing. That was a local government issue. We helped to facilitate discussion, but we're not really involved in any of the incentives. When Adobe bought Omniture here for $1.2 billion out of Utah County, they found that they really liked the environment they discovered in Utah, said, we would like to stay in Utah, but we're being courted by many other states. And so we needed to compete. And we said, well, you've said that if you stay in Utah, we'll create 1,000 jobs, we'll invest $110 million in a new campus, et cetera, et cetera. We said, if you will do that, if you will in fact do that, after you have done that and you create and generate an additional $100 million in income tax, we'll give you some of that income tax back over the following 12 years. But you have to do it first. That way the taxpayers' dollars are never at risk, and it's only post-performance, whatever you promise, you've got to deliver. And if you expand the economic pie, we'll give you some of that back in the form of a tax cut.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Governor Gary Herbert. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Utah's Governor, Gary Herbert. So at the open, I mentioned, you know, the two main themes we wanted to talk to you about today is the economy and jobs, really. And the other subject is education. So let's mm-hmm. switch now and talk about education. Utah's test rankings are right around the middle of the pack, a little bit above the middle of the pack. Our spending per pupil is, I believe, at the lowest in the entire nation. And your website says you'd like the funding to be at adequate levels. Do you feel today's funding is adequate?
I don't think today's funding is adequate, and I've been my number one budget priority since I've been governor is to, one, stop the cutting that was going on before I came in and to increase funding, and we've done that by $1.8 billion of new money into education in the last 5 years. It's not all about the money, but it certainly is some about the money. We have a lot of people that talk and emphasize only the input of money in the education system, and we ought to be talking about the results we're getting. And we're not only above average, we're in fact significantly above average for the return on our investment. And I would take the old Steve Covey approach. Steve Covey, a great businessman in his own right, said, let's start with the end in mind. The end in mind for me is let's become the number one best performing education system in America. We had naysayers when we said, let's become the number one best performing economy in America. And said, oh, are you kidding me? We can't do that. And yet we did it. So I think if we can focus and unite and come together, eliminate some of the divisiveness that's out there in the education world, we can actually become the best performing education system. It's going to take a commitment for us. It's going to take more resources as we continue to grow the economy. Right now, $3 out of every $4 of new money that comes into our system because of a rising, growing, expanding economy is now put into education. And clearly, if we're going to have long-term sustained economic growth, education is joined at the hip because we've got to have a qualified, educated, skilled labor force that aligns up with the demands of the marketplace. If we don't do that, our economy will underperform.
And what are some of those initiatives you'd like to see in place? Funding is one of them, but the actual programs themselves.
Well, one, we're putting together a 10-year education plan based on input from the business community, which is many times the end user of all of our students. They find a job. That's the practical aspect. Education is like virtue, its own reward, but the practical aspect of getting education is so you can get a job. And so we listen to the business community, what their demands are and what their needs are, to make sure that there's alignment there. We listen to our educators, our teachers, our principals, our superintendents, our school boards, our state school board, our legislators, which have the job to fund, you know, and control all of the money. And we ought to put together a 10-year plan so that we are united in our effort. We've been kind of scatterbrained, and unfortunately, I think in the past, I'd like us to unite with a 10-year plan. And the goal should be to become number one. For example, right now we've improved our graduation rates by 10 points over the last 5 years. We're at 85% graduation rate now. If we were 90, we'd be number one in the nation. So we're within shouting distance of actually accomplishing that goal. Our minority scores have jumped up 17%. So for those who have been left behind, at least in their culture, and for whatever reasons they're not doing as well in school, that sector of our society is improving. When you say we're slightly above average, in fourth grade on our NAEP scores, that's where we test and compare state by state, we're in the top 20 in our test scores at fourth grade. When you get to eighth grade, we're 12th in math on our NAEP scores. We're 10th in reading, language, arts, and we're 7th in science. So we're scoring way above average, punching way above what we're paying per pupil. Why? Because we have good parents. We have parents that care about their students. We have the largest percentage of two-parent families in America today. That makes a difference. We have teachers who are dedicated and committed and doing a great job in the classroom. And we need to pay them fairly because we, in fact, are facing a teacher shortage, and we need to recruit and retain teachers. So when I say it's not all about the money, but it's some about the money, some of it's about paying teachers commensurate to the job responsibilities and get them to choose teaching as a profession. All of us have got to work together. This is going to be a shared responsibility if we're going to become number one in America, and we need to focus on that goal and say that's the end, that's the goal. Now let's put a pathway in place how we can achieve that goal, and that's what the 10-year education plan we're developing is going to do.
Your opponent, Mike Weinholz, has proposed a tax, a corporate tax increase, to increase funding K-12. What's your thoughts on increasing taxes?
Well, there's only three ways to pay for education, and one is to grow the economy, which is what we've chosen to do, and it's, like I say, $1.8 billion is not anything to sneeze at. You know, so that part is working very well. That's in the mode of a Ronald Reagan. It's in the mode of a John F. Kennedy, who cut taxes and increased the economic growth and had more money, more revenue stream. Same with Reagan. Cut taxes, had a bigger revenue stream. Now, you got to have spending controls, and of course, unfortunately for Reagan, he had a Democrat-controlled Congress that spent more. Even though he doubled revenues, they spent three times more money. So there's got to be a partnership of revenue and spending, and we're pretty conservative and fiscally. We're only one of nine states, for example, that have a AAA bond rating in America today. So you can grow the economy. You can reprioritize, take money from over here on this project and put it into education. We've done that too. And you can then raise taxes, which is the third option. There's only the three. We actually have raised taxes on road construction and on our road areas, as you most of your listeners probably know, implemented this year. And that's designed to, one, we hadn't raised the gasoline tax in 18 years, and so our loss to purchasing power was dramatic. And also, that money comes out of the general fund, which also is used to supplement and augment education. So if you have to take money out of the general fund for transportation because you're not charging enough on the gasoline tax for the user fee, it hurts education. So we've raised the tax there to help put the funding on solid footing on roads, which now allows us to put more money into education. I'm very concerned about anybody who would propose an increase in income tax. They tried that in Chicago. Good Democrat, Pat Quinn, in Chicago, Illinois area, said, oh, we were having a shortage of money. Let's raise the income tax. They immediately lost 100,000 jobs over the next 6 months. We see people trying to leave California. Businesses are moving out of there in droves. Why? Because the same tax my opponent's proposing, the millionaire tax, which is just taxes on anybody making over $250,000 a year, is now driving business to leave California and look to elsewhere. A lot of them are coming to Utah. Same with New York. I mean, there's a reason why we're called business friendly, because we've got the right balance of regulation and taxation where the business entrepreneur, the risk taker, says, this is where I want to do business. And if you can have a growing, expanding economy, that's where you pay, how you pay for the bills. So anybody who thinks we ought to just raise the income tax willy-nilly, you know, is going to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs.
So, you know, many of those companies coming out of California are looking for technology employees. They're looking for programmers. You see the billboards on the side of I-15 now looking for programmers. You mentioned earlier education. A big role of education is getting jobs when you're out. How do we encourage more people to go into programming, technology-type jobs?
Well, the primary responsibility for your child's education is, guess what? The parents. You know, we have too many parents that drop their kids off at kindergarten, pick them up at 12th grade and say, hey, how was it? They need to be engaged. And fortunately, we have good parents here in the main here in Utah. So that's a step in the right direction. And the teachers, of course, are doing their job in the classroom, and we need to tell them thanks. We can't tell them thanks enough for the good work they're doing. I've been calling for the last 2 to 3 years for more counselors. to help augment the teacher and augment the parent, so that when a student has an opportunity to be interviewed and spend some time with a counselor throughout the school year, they can say, how you doing in math, how you doing in science, how you doing in history, English, and what would you like to be when you grow up? And if this is a pathway you want to take, let me help steer you with your education so that you'll be college and career ready when you graduate from high school. Our goal of pushing people out of high school into college, our goal of 66 by 2020, which we're one of only two states that are on track, in fact, to have that goal realized, it means we care about alignment with education. And we're trying to say to people, in a free market, you have to choose your own path. This is not China, where we're going to tell you what you have to be when you grow up. But we're going to also make sure that you have information so you can choose a pathway that aligns up with your own aptitude, what you'd like to do. You might want to be a nurse. You might be a lawyer. You might be a pipe fitter. You might want to be a machinist, a dental assistant. I mean, there's a lot of things in our applied technology colleges, our trades, which pay good money for good jobs above the average and gives you a good quality of life. But the operative word there is choice and counseling. And so you're going to find over the next couple of years we're going to have a significant emphasis and hopefully put more money into counseling to help steer our children in a direction where they get the skills necessary that align up again with the opportunities in the marketplace.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Governor Gary Herbert. Let me switch gears again. You're a proponent for local control. You've advocated for taking over control of 31 million acres of public land. The Utah legislature has set aside almost $15 million to fight the potential legal battle that's going to entail. Share with us your views on how local control of those public lands would help Utah's economy.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the public land issue on both sides of the issue. We have people that say we want to take back the public lands. You can't take back something you don't have never had. So that's a misstatement, a misnomer for what's trying to be done. On the other side, we have people that accuse us of trying to privatize the public lands. That's not true either. That's a falsehood. There's never been a desire to privatize these public lands. I've said multiple times, we're a public land state. We will always be a public land state. What we're trying to do is have an optimal management of the public lands, and certainly the state and local control, where we understand our backyard better than somebody 2,000 miles away, is an important aspect of that. Mismanagement by the federal government is, in fact, rampant out there. Look at our forests. We have fires that are burning out of control, burn into cities, and we say, why? Well, because the undergrowth has become so dense. We wait for a lightning strike, and then we let it burn for 3 months to clear out the undergrowth. And you say, why don't we just go in there and have a prescribed burn? We are the stewards, aren't we? Aren't we in charge? Well, that's wilderness. We can't do that. We have to just let Mother Nature take its course. And consequently, we lose a forest. We lost the lumber industry down south in Garfield County in that area because we couldn't spray for the bark beetle. The federal government would not let us spray for disease in our trees. And so not only did we lose a lumber industry, we lost a forest. And this is not unique to Utah, by the way. Let's look at the wildlands fire. We have cheatgrass out there that will be replaced with more drought-resistant, fire-resistant. Cheatgrass burns like a fuse. And so we have these potential fires that we ought to be on the preventative side of, but because of mismanagement by the federal government, we're always susceptible. Again, this is not unique to Utah. Look at the wild horses and burros issue, for heaven's sake. We have three times the amount of wild horses and burros on the lands out there, overgrazing, crowding out deer and elk, crowding out our domestic crops, our cattle, hurting our farmers and ranchers, utilizing water inappropriately in a desert climb that is really a critical issue because of mismanagement and lack of management of our wild horses and burros. I mean, we could go on and on, and we're just saying, look, the state has a role to play. They promised us at the time of statehood in 1896 that the lands not owned by the people, still owned by the federal government, would be disposed of. They would sell them. They would somehow dispose of the lands, as they've done in other states. It just never happened in Utah. And then in 1976, they passed a law in Congress, said, remember what we told you about in 1896? That's off the table. We don't have to do that anymore. We don't have to honor that obligation. That law, we believe, is unconstitutional. we're not being treated by like other states. And we're not saying that they, that we want to take them back. But we're saying if you dispose of them, the state of Utah is there ready, willing, and able to take on part of that responsibility in a shared responsibility with the federal government. We've never said we'll take back the national parks, our wilderness areas, our national recreation areas, all those areas that we typically think of management by the federal government would still be controlled and managed by the federal government. But other areas, we have an opportunity. It's silly for us, in fact, out in our because of the bureaucracy and the long term it takes to permit, say, for drilling a natural gas well. It takes us nearly 18 months to get a permit. If you're in North Dakota, it takes you 2 months to get a permit.
Well, let's talk about that because that's part of the controversy, right? Utah, I moved here from Cleveland, Ohio. Utah is a beautiful state. It's one of the reasons I moved here and have lived here for 20 years. Outdoor recreation is an important business to the state. It represents about 5% of the state's GDP. Competing interest is energy, or many people feel it's competing with outdoor recreation. It's a bigger business for the state. It's about a little over $20 billion a year, or 15% of the state's GDP. Do these economic interests, energy, and outdoor usage, do they have to be opposed? What's your views on balancing the two?
Doug, I'm the first governor in American history actually created a Department of Outdoor Recreation. We've done it, and we believe that there's great opportunities for outdoor recreation. Our tourism and travel grew about 8% last year. That's a big sector of our economic growth. Utah, by Fodor Travel, was named this past year as the travel destination in the world, not just our ski resorts, not just our national parks, but the entire state. We have 5 national parks. We have 43 state parks. This idea that somehow you cannot develop your natural resources, have farming and ranching, and still have tourism and travel and outdoor recreation is a myth. They're not mutually exclusive ideas. They can live in harmony. The BLM's own charter says that land should be managed for a multiple-use concept. That's all of the above. This idea that we've kind of moved towards, well, it's only for outdoor recreation, only tourism and travel, is in fact not what the BLM is supposed to be doing. And we just want to have an optimal management prospect here. Some of the things that we're fighting over on RS-247 roads and rights of way, why is that an issue? Because we have people out there in the extreme environmental community that wanted to designate everything wilderness, where there is no motorized vehicle, no opportunities for enhanced tourism and travel. They want people just backpacking. And so they're fighting, not because there are not roads out there, because there are. They just don't want them designated because if it's wilderness, by definition, has to be roadless. The sage-grouse issue. My gosh, with new technology, we have the ability with lateral development underground where we don't have surface disturbance only every 6 miles. That's a lot of space. And yet because of a sage-grouse and her habitat and what's trying to be imposed upon us, they want to create all that as sage-grouse habitat so they can shut down the ability to develop some of our energy resources. That's just wrong. It ought to be optimal. It ought to be a balanced approach. I put one of our top Democrats, top environmentalist, Ted Wilson, former mayor of Salt Lake City, over our balanced resource committee to say, we can find the appropriate balance. They're not mutually exclusive ideas. They can work in harmony. We have areas that are not as attractive for tourism and travel. And we can, in responsible ways, develop our extraction industry, including energy, protect our farming and ranching capabilities, and still enhance and grow our tourism and travel. And we've proven that to be true. Again, we grew 8% this past year. We are doing it all. And that's what should happen here in Utah.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Governor Gary Herbert. We only have time for another 2 or 3 questions. I want to circle back to an issue you brought up at the beginning of the interview, coal. We are a coal economy. We have a lot of coal resources. There are communities that their economic vitality is tied into coal. What do we do to help them?
Well, again, it's a matter of actually having a free market to make those determinations. We understand what the people of America want, and certainly the people of Utah. And they want to have, in fact, a sustainable energy supply. They don't want to have brownouts like they've had in California. They want to have a sustainable energy supply. When you turn on the light switch, lights go on. They don't want to have lines at the gasoline station to fill up their automobiles with gasoline. They want it to be sustainable. They also want it to be affordable. They don't want to bust the household budget, and businesses doesn't want to have to pay an extraordinary amount of money for energy. Forbes, when they named us the best place in America for business, cited one of the reasons was because we had a below the national average cost of energy. We've developed hydraulic fracking, for example, which has been a wonderful technology advancement. It's been around for a long time. It's been perfected. But now we're awash in natural gas, which is kind of a transition. But it goes to our third point that the American people want and Utah people want, and that's to have it cleaner. They want to have sustainable, affordable, and cleaner energy. And we're doing all of that in Utah, by the way. And we talk about energy or technology helping us with wind and solar, making it more economic. And that's great. I think we'll find breakthroughs that will allow it to compete on the marketplace. But guess what? Technology is also helping us with carbon-based fuels become more clean. Technology is going to solve this problem, and the market demands will, in fact, direct it in the right direction. Who knows what's going to be found next to help us with our energy of making it sustainable, affordable, and cleaner. Coal industry is going to have to adapt. There's new opportunities out there in coal, whether technology will help it with carbon, coal gasification, sequestration for carbon. We see a fellow in town here the other day talking about we can use coal for other things, carbon fibers, and do other things in manufacturing rather than just burn it for energy. So who knows what the marketplace will determine. The poorest entity to make a future decision today about the future is government. A few elite people getting around saying we know best, when the marketplace with its thousands, millions of machinations out there and creative thinking that says, well, there's a niche in the marketplace. I'll bet here's an idea. I'll risk capital. I'll risk time and energy, and they'll develop the new best thing based on the demands of the market. That's how it's supposed to work. It's only when government gets in the way and says we know best that it messes things up. We ought to keep government out of the way, off your backs, and out of your wallets.
So this capital, this investment is deployed, primarily the decisions are made by CEOs of companies. In many regards, you are the CEO of the state of Utah. And one of the questions I like to ask, normally we're interviewing business CEOs, that I like to ask CEOs is, you know, as you were thinking about the job of being governor before you were governor, and now you have the vantage point of having been the state's governor for 7 years, what's been the biggest surprise to you?
You know, because I was in business before, I've started 4 businesses of my own and, you know, been fairly successful in that regard. I certainly haven't got rich, but I've paid the bills and had some success. I understand the challenges of having to navigate the business regulation environment and having to pay more in tax than you actually make in profit and have to make payroll and getting up early and staying up late and adjusting to the demands of the marketplace. So I have that background, but I also came from local government and also served as lieutenant governor. So when I became governor, I was able to hit the road running with a wealth of experience. So this is not a novice here taking over the CEO responsibility of the state of Utah. What I did recognize is that government's a monopoly. Now, most of your business people you talk to, they work in a free market competitive environment where if you don't find a better way to do things, your competitor will find one and you'll be losing profitability and then market share and you'll be out of business altogether. We see that happen, the disruption of the marketplace. Not so with government. There's only one state government and we're going to be around tomorrow whether we're efficient or not. So what I've done is taken the business principles of competition and said, look, Utah is well managed, but we can do better. Let's push the envelope. Let's say we are going to impose upon ourselves the demand to get better and more efficient. And so we put a goal to, in fact, improve 25% efficiency in state government by the end of this year. I just got a report just yesterday. We're at 27.4%. We're going to reach our goal. That's good. How does that mean to the taxpayer? That means today in Utah, we have fewer state employees producing goods and services as government's designed to do. For about 750,000 more people. And yet you go back to 2001, you have to go back to 2001 to find a fewer number of state employees than we have today. That's 15 years ago. And yet we have 750,000 more people calling Utah home. That's efficiency. And that's saving millions and millions of dollars to the taxpayer every year because we don't have a growing labor force. It's actually shrinking. We've gone from one state employee to 117 Utah residents to today it's one in 149. And that's what I've learned. That's what we're doing. And that's taking a page out of the private sector. We're saying we know we're a monopoly. We're not in business. But let's, in fact, act like we've got competition out there and force ourselves to find more efficiencies in government. We've embraced technology and improved process. Do you know, here's the kind of the highlight everybody kind of chuckles about, the Department of Motor Vehicles. If there's ever, vision of government incompetence, it's the Department of Motor Vehicles. We've reduced the wait time in the DMV from 45 minutes to down to 4 in Utah.
Well, on that note, let's wrap up. Governor Herbert, thank you so much for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Well, Doug, it's great to be with you and have me back. Let's see how things go this next year.
Our guest this morning has been Utah Governor Gary Herbert. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Ross, thanks for putting this together. You can hear my entire interview with Governor Herbert on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.